Have your sponsor tell you about that. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear most of the time. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Now, these are not... We all see these things. We've all had these things happen. What's miraculous about these 12 promises is that when Bill wrote them, many of them hadn't happened to him yet. You know, you can find self-help books, there's all sorts of things. Well, yes, you become happy and secure, so secure, and you know you're never going to do that. But he wrote a set of promises in here. One of the reasons I think this is divine, that he did not know could hadn't even happened to him. And anybody's been sober very long has had it happen to them. They don't stay there, but they come and go because we're human beings. You know, almost after I was sober a few years, the closest I came to doubting the promises was 5.5 years sober. And my wife and children moved out to California. And I was so eager to make my children feel good and secure that I overspent and tasted a deep financial trouble. And I called up my sponsor. I had front teeth. Chuck, I said, you know, I was kind of joking, but I'm half serious. I, you know, I've really done very well, and I've been 5 years sober, and things are, Chuck, you know, I wonder, you know, since financial insecurity will leave me, and I tell you, I haven't had financial insecurity like this for, maybe the promises can't come true for people like me. I said, no, son, you've got it wrong. I said, fear of it, financial insecurity will leave you. You can be financially secure all the time, but just don't be afraid of it. I said, I think I hear the door. That's true. All of these promises come true to us. Anybody who's been sober any length of time has made a rudimentary attempt to work the steps. May not even be aware of it, but we will intuitively know how to handle things. Every day we handle things that used to baffle us. Just fact of living in the world and being of service to others, and self-seeking does slip. We have other thoughts than what's in it for me on a continuing basis, because we've been forced to do it here and trapped into it. But that's why the eighth and ninth step is the final cleanup of that. It gets us out of isolation. It gets us making use of the tools. It gets us back into the world around us, really. So it really boils down to two major categories so far of steps. One, where we're going to identify it. I'm a drinker, I can't stay sober, and there's a power here, and some kind of power will change it. And then the action steps, where I have to do things that I don't want to do, and that is really where I have to ask God's power to help me, because of myself, I will quit. But write that inventory, and make those amends, even when they're not worthy of it. And make the advice of the inventory and share that inventory with a human being and with God and myself. Get it out of my head. And then become willing to have God remove defects of character that I want to hang on to because they seem necessary to me. But I've got to be willing to get rid of them if they come up and when I can. And then humbly ask Him to remove these shortcomings. And then make a list of persons, the carnage I've caused behind me without being aware of it. A lot of people like me say, well, I just damaged myself freely. I've left a wake of carnage behind me I never meant to, because I'm convinced all I've ever wanted to be is a good man in a good world, and things get out of control. And then make those amends, and then I can at least walk with some degree of dignity and begin to take care of the maintenance steps that come up next. So I think that... I think the seventh step and the sixth step are critically important. I think the fourth and fifth steps are. I certainly think the eighth and ninth steps are. These action steps are the ones that do it. Where they take us from being victims into being masters of our fate with some degree of dignity. And when we're done with them, we're very glad we've taken them. Thank you. discussion time. People want to talk, make an observation, ask a question, ask me what's wrong with me.
Doug, my name is Clive Cameron.
Hi, Doug.
There's a paragraph in step 7. I'm a little confused by what you said about building up a recovering alcoholic self-worth. The paragraph says, as you know, that it is only by repeated humiliations that we achieve a measure of humility.
No, it isn't. It doesn't say only by repeated humiliation. It says it is by, I think, to some effect, repeated humiliations can bring humility. Let me see. I know where it is too. I think. Where the hell is it? They moved it. They. Don't you know who they are? How long have you been in AA? Well, I know just the sentence you're saying. That's what I say. Yeah, is it? I'm going to read the sentence. Well, anyway, here, there's a phrase that talks about humiliation. You can find it when we're talking about going back and fill. Going to my song and dance. I am not questioning the fact that humiliation brings us. But humility and humiliation are two different things. Humiliation are some of the things that drive us to have to seek the things we find in humility. But I don't think that's the only way to get to humility, because humility, as I say, in my opinion, and I believe it to be true, and I don't think it's any... What does it say? It says, you're right, it was only by repeated humiliations that we were forced to learn something about humility. For us, the process of getting a new perspective was unbelievably painful. I believe that's true, is what he says. But I also know that it is not a contradiction in terms, because the humiliations give you the pain that make you take the actions to build up your ego. In other words, what we're saying is, I want to build up my self-worth so I don't have to have an overcompensating apparent arrogance and ego. Do you know what I'm saying at all?
Yeah, but it says, that's the threat. Ego deflation is the threat.
That's right. The ego, the bad ego, the outside ego, but I'm talking about self-worth, not ego. You build up your self-worth, and that diminishes the phony ego. You understand that difference? Because I'm not saying it's ego deflation, but it's the ego of the false ego. Yes, I'm all right. I'm fine. Don't look inside and see that there's a weak little guy trying to move the arms and legs and say, I'm all right. It is my experience to build up self-worth to lower the ego.
Yeah, thank you. Clancy, doesn't it also say that the basic ingredient of all humility is the desire to seek to do God's will?
Yes, it does say that. Of course, what God's will is a metaphysical conundrum.
Closer to mine, actually.
Yeah. God, I'll tell you, talking about God's will, and we should bring up the 11th step. But who's the guy that wrote Seventh Story Mountain? Thomas Merton. Spent 18 years in the Gethsemane Monastery in Gethsemane, Kentucky. We all know that, hopefully. He went in there because he wanted to study to find God's will for him. He was in a non-speaking, self-abasing monastery. That's a tough monastery. And he came out of that monastery after 18 years back into the world, and he wrote a prayer that's on my wall. And it said, "Dear God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me. And the fact that I think I'm following your will does not mean that I'm actually doing so. But I do believe this. I believe the desire to please you does, in fact, please you. I hope I never do anything apart from that desire. because I know if you'll do this, you'll never leave me in the shadow of death or to leave to face my troubles all alone. Now, if a guy who spent 18 years in silent meditation on a daily basis trying to study God's will, if he can't find out, there's not much chance I'm going to find out before supper time. That's why God's will is kind of an ethereal thing. It's an intuitive thing, but it's something dramatic. That's why Bill says in our literature again and again, it's good to check it with somebody else to make sure that it's not obsession. Because if I think about anything long enough that I want, it becomes God's will. So to do God's will, is, as far as I'm concerned, is to take the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the closest thing I know to God's will. And that's how we maintain humility, is by taking these actions that keep us out of becoming, having to be something we're not, to prove, to make up for our deficiency. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, I don't think I said that's what being humble was. I said, but that's what you have to do here. Maybe I said it was humble. I'll have to check the tapes. But I don't think so. But I mean, I would not take exception to that statement. I wouldn't mind making that statement. Accepting the fact that that I am not the top of the chain, whether it be sponsor or God or whoever. And I have to be very careful when I'm getting my direct authorization from God, because I have a tendency to change those a little bit, so I want to check with people around me. But I think that's certainly true. I would have no objection to that at all. I think these cleanup steps are really so gratifying, and yet we all fight against them because they're absolute opposite of what my intelligence would tell me would be effective for those symptoms. Yes, ma'am. Well,
I see.
Yeah, well, when to do so. They're quite clear about that, the 12 and 12. And in the big book, where I think the test you give yourself, will everyone feel better as a result of this event? You know, I see guys, I want to make a clean breast of things. So I went to my wife. And I said, I've been screwing the neighbor for 28 years. And you know, she wouldn't accept that amend. No, she won't. Will you accept a subpoena tomorrow? You know. I think that's actually one of the examples of the book where it talks about that. But I've actually had guys tell me that I sponsor. I could just punch them in the face. Why'd you talk to me about that before you did it?
Well, do God's will.
Try living alone. That's God's will for you for the next couple of years. But I think that it's a relatively easy litmus test on that, is that you will it make everybody involved not feel worse? That's what all it boils down to. I mean, it's quite simple, really. We can talk phrases and inner meanings, but that's the basic sense. Will everybody feel better? Yes, Jack.
Somewhere in the book, I don't know where, it seems Kurt's instruction to fit ourselves to be a maximum use.
Yes. That's true. Well, okay. The major purpose of these steps is to enable us to be of maximum use to God and to our fellows. I'm not making light of it, but that really says it all, Jack. That really explains it. You know, I come so close hour after hour, just they put them there just to see if I'm alert. The thing, you know, Dr. Bob, to synthesize it all of this badinage about the steps and what they really mean and what does it really mean? We forget sometimes that it's just, I can't know. Bob, when he was dying, giving that talk in the First International Convention, and he said, we're so glad to be here, of course, and our program, when boiled down to the end, just means this: love and service. We all know what love is, and we all know what service is. If you want scientific things, leave it to the scientists.
we are to be of service and to give a hand to the man behind us. And all of these steps are enable us to do that. And it's, the reason that they have to be kind of hard is because we are caught up with self-will people who have used alcohol to anesthetize the results of their actions, and now they've lost the anesthesia and have to live with the pain of them without any way to cope. And what we're getting is a way to cope. That this morning I began a story. I started to tell something, and then I got caught up and I forgot the end of it, to tell the end of it. And that is, I was talking about spirituality, and the closest I'd ever come to true spirituality, I felt, was in Miami Beach in 1970. And I mentioned Bill Wilson talk, and I forgot everything I was going to say and went on to something else.
Yeah.
So I'll go back and pick that up. Come on, folks. A lot of important data coming on down here. All right. Finish the story I started this morning about Miami Beach. So Bill Wilson, that was the last time he had talked. But I was pleased because, oh God, come on, folks. This isn't your home group. We start on time here. I hate to have to go through this dreary exposition one more time. I bet it's going to be a good tape. Because they're going to explain it again, for Christ's sake. This morning. Mind, you're so eager to challenge what I say. Come and sit down. Pot chick. This morning. This is the last time I'm responding. Anybody after this is going to have to give me hearsay. I started talking about how close I came to reaching spiritual nirvana. It was at Miami Beach in 1970. Then I got caught up in Bill Wilson going just off there. I forgot what I was going to say. But I want to say this because it's, at least for me, an indication of what happens to people when they find spiritual breakthroughs that really enable them to reach a new plateau. One of the things that had come, just an example, for example, in the late 1960s, they started the custom, started the Brentwood meeting in Los Angeles, of holding hands when they said the Lord's Prayer. It had never been done before that I ever heard of it. And people that would come to our meeting and want to hold hands. The sponsor didn't hold another hold hand. Hold hands, not me. Between God and us. And I had rather strong opinions on things like that, other things. And I went down to Miami Beach and I was pleased and blessed to be asked to be the noon speaker on July 4th. Which was nice because we were able to talk on July 4th as our Freedom Day, and we could talk about the freedom from alcohol, just cloying, hideous. Several diabetics went into a coma. But the touching thing about it was the first speaker that morning was the guy that had taken me to my first meeting in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And the last speaker that night was Chuck C., my current sponsor. And it was just as though I was part of an intricate whole. Just, and I talked at noon, and Bill Wilson gave his last talk, his dying talking. I was spiritually transformed. I thought, I have been a contentious old peep. I'm going to go home, and I'm going to be a different person. No more pettiness, no more selfishness, no more self-seeking. I'm going to make use of the program as I understand it. And I got home, I felt transformed. And next morning, I got up to go to work. The advertising engineer was working with me. The other Santa Monica City was going downtown. I had my rear view mirror so I could see the road, but I could also see me. I'd never seen myself with an aura before, really. I just. Kind of a Maybelline look. I just. And I thought, people are going to think this is strange, but it's going to be a new life for me. I went underneath the San Diego freeway on my way downtown, and some little old lady came off that freeway in a Toyota, about 70 miles down, just bam, just missed me by the 16th of an inch, just almost creamy. I mean, really, almost. You might have had to have a priest back to conduct this thing and charge you $50 for fifth step. But I got a special rate, $39.95. Jack is doing my booking for me. But anyway, the new spiritual leader of the Western States, the man who had found God in peace, without even missing a beat, had his window down saying, "God damn you! What the hell's wrong with you, you bitch?" Uh-oh. And I got back and I said, "Well, I may have to need 3 or 4 meetings to get that feeling back." And I've been looking for it ever since. Just at the next meeting, I know. But it's a good example. We like to think that we can achieve breakthroughs, and we do, we can. But they're always transitory. So we're dealing with human emotions beyond our control. I think about that, I sometimes talk about that in my talk, you know, as an example of emotions, how we have to change our emotions a little bit. Is that what Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the things, I guess what you call a type A personality, rather intense. Not as intense as I used to be. More intense than I'm going to be when I'm dead. But I'm an intense driver. I mean, I'm a great freeway. And I don't like to have people cut me off or treat me badly. I don't do that to them. And what one of the things AA has taught me to do is when people cut me off or drive badly around me, I no longer have to chase them past my exit. If I haven't caught them by my exit, good hunting, Red Baron. We'll meet again. Right? And the trouble with AA is when you do catch him, when you're in AA, you can't do anything anyway. But there's a satisfaction of driving next to him and giving him a raise. It isn't much, but it's like the Indians counting coup, you know. And they probably don't even know it, but it cheers me up a little bit. I try not to do it, but God makes me sometimes. A few years ago, I was coming off the Santa Monica Freeway onto the Harbor Freeway, and a little girl in a car again almost killed me. She came across 2 lanes and almost put me into a pillar. I'll tell you, I drove like Mario Andretti to get out of that. And I got next to her down the road a ways, and I gave her a quadruple raise. And I suddenly realized, plus she's only about 17. Just a young girl driving, probably didn't know what she was doing. Long blonde hair. I said, "She looks exactly like my granddaughter. That could be my granddaughter." It isn't, but it could be. And here she is, trying downtown driving, and some old poop is giving her a quadruple ray, for Christ's sake. What kind of a guy am I? So I smiled at her, and she went, "Oh, man!" I'll tell you, if I hadn't been a spiritual leader of 100 million Muslims, I'd have put it right into the wall. I'll tell you, I just... But these things are a continuing basis. There's always emotions out there. We have to learn to live with them. So I... I got a ticket for carrying a 45 in the 38 caliber lane. What is this, some participation meeting? Come on, Frank. Dummy up. But as long as you're here, I've been having this pain right here. I don't know why I'm never invited back anywhere. I try to be nice, but Tenth step. Continue to take personal inventory and where we're wrong, promptly admit it. And that we're talking about this morning. That's the step where we steer, and we continue to steer, and we make changes and corrections and adjustments in our path. And it sounds so simple in the reading. Continue to take personal inventory. We kind of check yourself. Not a continue, how am I doing? Incidentally, in passing, if you know someone who's feeling bad a lot, you can tell them, I don't know if they're able to break the habit, but one of the ways to always make sure you feel bad is to always examine how you're feeling. How am I feeling? Not very well, now that I think about it. You know, all of this is to get out of self. That's one of the great reasons why psychoanalysis has traditionally been ineffectual in the treatment of alcoholism. The psychoanalysis gets inside, and we must get outside. Self-obsessed people need every tool they can get outside. But we take an inventory to see how we're doing, how we're feeling. And it says in the book that we evaluate if we've hurt anybody that day. It also says there's nothing wrong with evaluating if we've done something good. To say, I really did that. I handled that pretty well. I acted pretty good in that situation. I've got to try to remember to do that again. And if I hurt somebody, or sloughed over somebody, or handled something badly, I can try to do better tomorrow, or I can... Certainly, if I can think of it and bring myself to do it, I can say I'm sorry. Now, it seems so simple as to say, when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. Well, when you're wrong, just say I'm sorry. But people like me, perhaps like you too, I don't know, but it has to be pretty cut and dry before I'm convinced it's my fault. Because I can really see both sides of it, and now that I see it, it's your fault. That's whose fault it is, and I'm just reacting. And it usually takes a little while later to think, I did that. One of the things that helps you most to get along in the world, it seems to me, is when you can do this. Project yourself in how it looks to them. Now, you have to be, I think, sober a while, active a long time to do that. But it's amazing how different when you think, if you could put yourself in the position, how it looks to them. And it really is so often, like I was saying this morning, because everyone thinks they're right. And they think they're right. They're not saying, I think I'll do the wrong thing just to hurt somebody. We all think I'm right. And to admit I'm wrong and to say I'm sorry. Now, when you're new, it's hard because when you feel inadequate, you hate to admit you're inadequate by saying you're sorry. When you're sober 33 years, you hate to say you're sorry because you shouldn't have to say it when you're sober 33 years. There's always some reason not to say it at a low level. But you say it because it makes you feel better. To apologize, to when you're wrong, promptly admit it. But there are four things that Bill suggests in the 12 and 12 that I think are really something we have to try to adopt in our daily life, because we're surrounded by stimuli that we can't control, of things that make us react, we emotionally change, come back, and that leave us in a state of disharmony with our surroundings. And the first, I jotted them down here, the first thing he describes is we must pray for and try to, and all of these things are things we have to pray for. I don't think we can get them on our own. We have to pray for almost as to say, help me maintain these. I think it's one of the good reasons I am not in favor of non-AA literature. I am not in favor of literature that is not approved by the World Service Office, because you can get to all sorts of damnedest crap. But I say that so I can make one exception. The exception of truth rule. When I was new and thereafter, one of the great helps in my life was a little 24-hour book. The only thing ever put out by Hazelden that was worth anything, in my opinion. But I'll tell you, when I was newer, before I became a speaker, and sometimes since, I wake up in the morning and always open and read that little book. And it just starts you off on the right path. Because otherwise you get up and you just feel, you can feel negative before you even get out of bed. But read that little thing. And I got reading that because, by an odd thing, I never did like that kind of literature, because I think it's hokey and reminds me of countless religious exhortations that have never worked. But then one day, when I was sober about 4 months, I was sitting in the club in Los Angeles, the 16th club, feeling sad, thinking, Jesus, I just lost my job as a, I lost my job as a furniture mover that day. That only lasted from morning till noon, which is really a long run on a job. But I was in one of my sensitive moods, and the guy said to me, "Hey, you, without the tape, you bumped my lamp." No, it was taken. I broke the lamp. There are just some times you can't push creative people. You know that, yeah. And I just went fired again. And I hope that guy finds me someday and makes his amends. But I was sitting there thinking, what the hell is the purpose? I haven't got anything. Even the people who got sober after I did are coming in here bubbling and are feeling good and they're going home to their families for dinner. And I'm living in this, thinking, I've been out of the car a few times a week here and the sofa with all this back here and offended the people I stayed with. And what the hell is the purpose? You know, what's the use? This was 2 months before I got to a suicidal friend. And somebody said, "You're not feeling very good, huh?" I said, "No, I'm not." He said, "What? You ever seen this old book?" I said, "I've seen it. Why don't you read it?" "Yeah, you bet. They tell me Jesus will save me. I'll certainly read that. That'll help a lot." We threw it down. I opened it. Just broke it down to dates, as you probably know. I thought, I have nothing. Now, what is the spiritual message for today that's going to transform my life? I opened it February 10th, as I recall. And I couldn't believe my eyes. Said there, like a tree, I must be stripped of a lot of dead branches. I must be like a dead tree, and all the flowers gone and everything, in order for with the spring to have new branches and new leaves and new trees, all because of this intensive pruning. I could not be well without the pruning. Remember, I'm in the hands of a master gardener who makes no mistakes in his pruning. My God, how did they know that? How do they know I'm a dead tree standing here? I'm sure it's just coincidence. I don't think God made the whole universe stop. Somebody get that message to him today. You know, let Jupiter blow up. Better get the sunburst in the 6th Club. But just a, whatever it was. And I think, my God, that's it. And a little while later, I stole a copy of the book. I made amends for it later. I paid partially for it. But I first got a little room, a little apartment for years. I read that book every morning before I got up, because it always gave me a start. And that is really a great thing to get you started right in the morning. It's so easy to fall into a negative thing before you go. But the things that God asks, or the book suggests that I ask God for, one, to allow me to maintain some self-restraint. When my emotions are triggered, to not shoot right back, to somehow force myself to bite my tongue and to think about my reaction. Because you can destroy people and things with those reactions. You can answer back to a child in a way that'll take you a year to regain his faith sometimes. It's just hideous how you just, yeah! And they don't know you're just out of sorts today. They just, got to learn that self-restraint. And I can't always do it, but I got to try to remember that. And I'll tell you, when I was thinking about it, about this step earlier today, I think, I got to go back working on that, because I'm in a position now of such power where I work, that I've allowed myself the luxury quite often of reacting any way I want to, because there's no one to say no to me. I got to get back to being a good human being. I didn't ever intend it to. But I'll tell you, this is a, I should say in passing, because as I told you, I've never done a seminar on the steps before. I talked about it working with newcomers. But it's been a marvelous experience for me. I've had to re-examine what I believe and why I believe it. And it probably never helped anybody here, but boy, it sure helped me. I'm going to go home and think, I heard what I needed to hear. But self-restraint. And then he says, the second thing, pray for it. To make an honest analysis of what is involved. How did this come up? Instead of just saying, well, did it? why, what made him or her do this? What is the trigger that I've done that made them react this way, that makes me react? Now, before I react with a scream or a yell or a pout, try to restrain myself from entering, and then try to have an honest analysis, if I can, why has this come up? Not only possible for human beings. And the third item is, then comes the willingness to admit when the fault is mine. That's what it says in that step. But that's a hard thing. Because so often, on the spur of the moment, the fault is never mine. It's always theirs. And I can react to that basis. But that, before I react, I have to stop and think. Somehow use self-restraint. And then evaluate what brought this about. Of course, it goes a little faster than talking about, because you run like a computer. And if I am wrong, I have to be willing to admit it, even though my feelings are hurt. Why? So I'll be a spiritual, so I'll be a male Mother Teresa, so I'll be a fine saint-like creature? No. So that I will live in harmony in the world around me, so I won't live with a grinding in my stomach. A lot of people like me would spend my life grinding, proving I'm right. I'm right! And I'll show you. I can just see to my gravestone. He was right! And he died at 29. Wow! Stomach fell out. And then the fourth thing that he writes is the equal willingness to forgive when the fault is theirs. That's a little more difficult. Equally difficult. But I have, you know, it's one thing to say, yes, I'll forgive them, but when they're right in your face, it's a little different psychologically. But I think that is really the message of the second half of that step. The first half is quite simple. Continue to take personal inventory, check yourself. Not a continuous basis, but at least daily, maybe once in a while in the day. Say a little prayer, ask God for His will, give you a little help. And then pray, hopefully on a daily basis, but when you can, maybe sometimes more, maybe sometimes less. For these four things, I just, they're as important as any four things I know in AA for the ongoing use. For self-restraint, to bite my tongue when I'm ready to just blast. As I was saying about the other step, to not take out my hostility on people who can't ask you back, especially, but not to do it on anybody. And then to try to analyze honestly what has brought this contretemps around. And then, when I am wrong, even though I hate to do it, to admit I'm wrong. And if they are wrong, to somehow forgive them. And that's the message of the 11th step. Anything beyond that is just badness, as far as I'm concerned. Take the inventory and to try to continue to live in some degree of harmony with the world was without leaving an additional wake of pain and heartache and resentment and despair behind you. Then you get to the 11th step, which is, we all know what that is, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, as we understood it, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. I think there's a very good reason. At least it may be accidental, but it worked out fine. But that is just about the end of the steps. Because I would hate to think of newcomers being asked to meditate much. Or anybody who didn't have a lot going for them, because it gets pretty spooky in there. If you ever want to destroy an alcoholic, a new alcoholic, even an old one, just go sit in your room in the dark and think about things for an hour. Have your pistol right along with you, so you can. Meditation is a dangerous animal for unsettled personality. It seems to work for people in the Gethsemane Monastery and some AA members, it's fine. But it's an individual thing. Meditation, we like to think of as sitting for hours. in the contemplation of God's will. Most of us can't do that. Most of us have about a 38-second attention span off ourselves. That's about, well, that's it for then. Now I can get back to myself. We'd like to meditate, but meditation also has a tendency to become obsession if we are unsettled, at least for people like me and many people I know. We were talking about this again at this breakfast, I guess, really much. This, one of the ways, one of the great mistakes I used to make when I was new is when I woke up in the middle of the night and couldn't get back to sleep, I'd think, this is a good time for meditation. I can't sleep anyway. So I lay in the dark and meditate. And it's just a miracle I didn't kill myself or run away. I talked to my sponsor about that and said, you little puke. He explained. He gave me a law that I've told everybody knew ever since then, or anybody not to me. If you wake up in the night and you can't get back to sleep, quit. Don't lie in the dark and think. That is absolutely the worst thing I can think of. Turn on the light, read, go watch television, have a snack. But that hour, everybody's defenses are at their lowest, and you lay in the dark long enough, and life becomes hopeless. It is literally hopeless and despairing. And you just, and it sounds like it's some sort of a cop-out, but that's so true. To this day, it doesn't happen much anymore, but I always have something to read by my bedside table, or a crossword puzzle to do. I have a crossword puzzle in my room. If I wake up in the night, I'm going to go back to sleep. If I can't go back to sleep, I'm not going to lie there and think, because I know that absolutely abnormal perception of reality. So that is what they mean by meditation either. I think the meditation is the contemplation of how to increase my knowledge of and application of God's will for me. When you really don't know what God's will for you is, as that prayer that Thomas Merton wrote, I do not know the will for me. And to think that I'm following your will, does that mean I'm doing it? And if he doesn't know, who the hell knows? So I think in step 11, in the 12 and 12, they have a Bill writes a thing that to my intents and purposes can serve as meditation for anybody. You can sit and think about this as long as you can, and you'll be in good shape. And it's that simple prayer in the 11th step that really tells us, to the best of my knowledge, what you're trying to do here. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there is hatred, I may bring love, that where there is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness, that where there is discord, I may bring harmony, that where there is error, I may bring truth, that where there is doubt, I may bring faith, that where there is despair, I may bring hope, that where there are shadows, I may bring light. That where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand rather than to be understood, to love rather than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds. It is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. Amen. And in just a couple sentences, that's what he writes. As beginners meditation, we might now reread this prayer several times very slowly, savoring every word and trying to take in the deep meaning of each phrase and idea. It will help if we can drop all resistance, for in meditation, debate has no place. We rest quietly with the thoughts, so that we may experience and learn. And I, as far as I can see, if I could live my life just meditating on those thoughts, I would have, that would be the summation of everything I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a prayer of St. Francis of Assisi that was written long before AA came along. It has nothing to do with AA, but has been happily adapted for our book. I think that an increased One of the problems I find sometimes in people and sometimes myself, I get such knowledge of what should be done, and it gives me such satisfaction, I don't do it. I just go through lectures, sometimes just being saint-like. And, please get out of my way, you sick person, I'm being saint-like. There's an interesting thing that sometimes you can grow right out of it. Thank God I've been goofy enough so I haven't been able to do that. But some people are able to do it. They come here, and they come to AA, and they find it, and they find spiritual helps, and one day they float right off the top. Don't you go to meetings anymore? I don't need anymore. I walk hand in hand with my partner. Pretty hard to debate that. And one day his partner gives him a beer, and here he comes. Oh, well, I think I'll try AA again. There are all kinds of examples of people who become too spiritual and no longer done the things that keep people sober. There are all kinds of examples of people who haven't done things too spiritual who have not stayed sober. Somehow there's a comfort zone in there where we have to stay. It's an interesting thing that you say, how long you have to stay in AA? I don't know. There are people that are alcoholics. You may have one in your group. I don't know. Who take pride in saying such things as, I never took any damn fourth step. And I'm sober. And I've been sober 20 years. And you're just that little puke 2 years saying you have to take one? Ha 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 ha. Those are suggested steps. I remember when I was about 3 years sober, I looked at the guy trying to give him, the guy didn't have any front teeth. I tried to write an inventory. And we went to a meeting and we heard one of these old pukes. I've been sober 18 years. And I haven't written an inventory. Don't listen to anybody who does. And we went home and said, well, Plant, he said, that guy's been sober 18 years. And he says, I don't have to write an inventory. You've been sober 3 years and say I do. Who should I believe? God, that's a terrible... What's the answer to this one? I'm going to simulate a cardiac arrest just to take the attention off. I finally thought of the answer a couple days later and I finally told him, but then lost some of its magic when you have to wait 2 days to get the answer. Hello, is that the answer to that question you asked me? Utilize, don't analyze. No. That's not the answer. The answer I should have told him is this. Well, you haven't taken an inventory of 18 years. Is that the way you want to feel after 18 years? Live it up. I know how to feel that way the day I got sober. Or do you want to be like one of these guys we see ahead of us who tell you with their eyes that AA works, not with their mouth, but with their eyes? Yes, I've done these things and I feel good. Or do you want to be like, he says, you have to do it. But even those people, I think, in my opinion. Now, in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill refers to this. It's really amazing how much stuff he got in that book. Because he did really, as I said, didn't know enough to write it. 3 years sober, strong by failure. And he wrote stuff that we make breakthroughs 20 years after 20 years of life. And my God, he had it in that book all along. But he wrote about, he didn't know what they were, but he called them alcoholics of our type. And that implies, and certainly says, there are alcoholics of different types. There are some alcoholics who have alcohol problems, and they stop drinking, and they stay sober. There are some alcoholics who need help to get sober, medical help. That's why some of these hospitals can, like Chick Shadell, have advertisements. We will cure your alcoholism in 10 days. And they do. They got successes. There are these people who are physically addicted to alcohol, and they get off, they get them off, and they give them some shape-up, little follow-up, and they're all right. But they are not alcoholics of our type. Alcoholics of our type are characterized by what they call in the book an obsession of the mind coupled with an allergy of the body. Or in other words, to put it, people who
find sobriety untenable and enough unwritten untenable. And making them sober doesn't heal anything, it just makes them more suicidal. So that is why alcoholics of our type, when I see someone who's gone 18 years without working the steps, I have to believe he's not an alcoholic of our type. He might be an alcoholic of some type, and he may be sober, and he may sit around here destroying newcomers year after year, but he tells me by his being that he's not an alcoholic of our type. Because in 18 years, if he'd have been an alcoholic of my type, he'd have committed suicide. He'd have been drunk. He'd have been something. So I think that we have to remember that alcoholics of our type must do these things. If we don't, something bad happens. That is why I started to say some time ago that the steps we take here are not designed to make us holy or good, but to live in some degree of harmony. We seek through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. By this time, hopefully, we are up to believing in God. I guess there are still some people who still believe in AA at that time, or even their sponsor. And that's all right. They'll stay sober. But the time comes when you'd like to have something a little more permanent than your sponsor. But, I mean, I think if you change, your perceptions change, you'll find something. God, as you understand it to me, God became a source of a force for good, a force sending me a picture of, as I said the other couple of hours ago, a peace of mind, of grace. That God's grace is available to me in almost the proportion I'm willing to go for it. But many times, every fiber of my being is against turning that knob, so I don't. Now they say, if God exists, why do people get cancer? I don't think the grace of God has anything to do with the virus of cancer. I think, who knows why some people get cancer and who don't. I know today why more people die of cancer than ever did before. Because they have found the answer to polio. And they have found the answer to heart problems. And they have found the answer to many things. So people now survive to die of cancer. So who knows why that is. Maybe next year they'll find somebody that will find an answer for cancer. But people are going to die anyway. We get the impression that they're going to die. They say, if God exists, why is there pain and agony? I don't know why there's pain and agony, nor is anybody else. Maybe God has anything to do with it. Maybe the devil has anything to do with it. Maybe just there's pain and agony. But I know this, in my life, I have come to believe that the grace of God exists, and that grace falls on me, whether I have cancer or whether I don't. It's frightening when you think you have cancer. It's hard to remember God's grace is there. On the other hand, I've come to believe little by little, we were talking about this at lunch, I've come to believe that maybe, well, let me put it this way. 2 or 3 years ago, they thought I'd cancer the vocal cords. I took off part of my vocal cords. And when you think you have cancer, I'll tell you, it doesn't take long before you think I'm going to be dead soon. And it's scary. And someone recommended a book to me to read called Life After Life, which is a compilation of medical reports from around the world. And nothing to do with religion, nothing, no metaphysical thing, just some doctors. It's about people who have died on the operating table and been revived. And this one doctor discovered, so many of these people report to their, they all seem to have had the same dream, very spooky. People in New York and India and every place all over the world. And the dream was always the same. And when they came to, they were going down a corridor to warm light. And it seemed to be the fruition of everything they'd sought. And they were happy. And they were so glad. And then just they almost got there, a force pulls them back. I'd want to go back. That's where I want to be. And they go back and sometimes they can see the old pain-racked body in their dream. They have to go down and get into it. And they wake up and say, what a funny dream I had. Now that same dream was held by people all over the world. And he's not making a point. He just says that's a funny dream. In fact, they now have another second book out on the same subject. Now, You don't have to believe in it. But I like the sound of it. I prefer to believe that. It has nothing against what my church says or what AA says or anybody else. It's not conflict with anything. And I like to think that the day will come someday when I will be sitting with my sponsor and my old friends, and maybe you, sitting around somewhere laughing at our little attempts to stay alive, the same way now we sit in AA and talk about our little attempts to stay drunk. That's all we knew. I'll tell you what a profound effect it has had on my life. It's been a year since I've tensed up with an airplane when they bounce. I'm not at all feel bad about dying. Sometimes I'm disappointed when I don't. You know, it sounds ridiculous. I don't mean that I want to die, but I'm not afraid of dying. And when you get to be my age, or most of your age, you see your friends around you dying, and really, dying gets considerably less frightening as you get older. Because you realize, God, my sponsor's over there, and my friends are over there, and somebody's left saved me a seat somewhere, I'm sure of that. I sometimes think in this whimsical way that I should really die soon, because at the big meeting in the sky they may have all the speakers booked and I'll be a listener for eternity. So that begs the question, why not commit suicide and get out of here? But that's another part of the equation. I also have a secret feeling, it must be my old Puritan Norwegian background, that you got to pay your dues. We all got a finite thing we got to go through here somehow. When it's up, you go. When you commit suicide, it's undone, and you got to go do it somewhere else. So you got to go do it. Might as well just do it and tap dance through it. And well, have a wonderful day. They're going to screw me again. I know that. Now that's a belief I have. I certainly wouldn't recommend that to anybody else. But I think to myself, most of my young life, living in terror and fear of a hateful God, and when I did commit suicide in such insanity, I just wanted to go to hell and get rid of my guilt and pain, and now find myself living in the world with some degree of comfort and dignity, and enjoying living, but not being afraid to die. I mean, it's an odd thing. That's a spooky thing. If I got nothing else from AA than that, that would be enough almost, just to live in some degree of dignity. Something else, three, four years ago, I went to the Norwegian Lutheran Church, talked about my dad dying. I sat in the Norwegian Lutheran Church. I'd done this with my mother a year later. I remember sitting with his little casket, Norwegian Lutheran Church, big church, a lot of old Norwegians there, a lot of old church members that I'd known for years. Looked around that church, that I'd sat in that church a lot of times in my youth, and just know there's a vengeful, hateful God that's going to get me because I'm a bad person. Isn't it amazing? By doing some kind of dumb steps that he seems to have no application to anything, I have come to believe, without being aware of it, that the God in this church is the same God that's in my meeting in West Los Angeles. The God in this church means well for me. He loves me. Can't believe it. I looked at all those old Norwegians that were going to that church every week for 60 years. And they will never find that out. They sit in a spiritual frown of, I hope God doesn't get me today. And we joke about that, but that really is true. You see old line, hardcore church members, they don't smile in church. They live in, I don't say they feel bad, but they... I think to myself, if I got nothing else than that out of AA, I'd be repaid for all the work you do. To live with that ominous fear that the hounds of heaven are going to get me and tear me up. The hounds of heaven are on my traces and I can't escape. And that's a great feeling, to feel that isn't going to happen. One of the things that brings about is to seek through prayer and meditation, to try to improve my conscious contact with this God, as I understand him, and then to pray. To pray what? praying for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry it out. Not falling into that old thing of telling, you know, it sounds so nice to say, God, please, please see that I get this job. That's so crass. What I'm telling you is, God, I make the decision what's right for me, and you execute it. Another one that uses the book that describes as an example, and it sounds so funny, to pray, gee, Mrs. Collins has got such a terrible case of cancer, please, God, help her die. Equally bad. I'm telling God what to do, as though He doesn't know what's best for the world until I tell Him. It is my, what I'm saying to God is, I will decide what should be done, and you execute it. And that's why I think that prayer is so important. I don't know what the purpose of the world is, but I know this. I can be satisfied with praying for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. And that's pretty hard to know the knowledge of God's will for me. But it's the same thing we've talked about all the way through the steps. You get an intuitive feelings of what you should do and what you shouldn't do. And most of us know when we're on the path and when we're not. Except for momentary aberrations when we've allowed ourselves to justify and rationalize ourselves off the path. And then it becomes painful. Then you realize, hey, got to get back on it. And not spend my day defending the fact that the path is really over there. Because that's lethal. So I think that I don't suppose, when I go to bed at night, I pray. Because I'm such a conniving sneak. I wish I weren't, but I am. I've tried to train myself never to pray for anything from God. At night, I thank Him for keeping me sober. I thank you, God, for keeping me sober through this day. Do those little things. In the morning, I pray God to help me do His will for me today. Maybe to die, I don't know. Maybe to be decapitated. Maybe to have my leg ripped off. I don't know. Maybe it's to feel, maybe to help somebody save their life. I don't know. But the knowledge of God's will, I'm having a little difficulty getting started in the morning, to start the habit again of reading the 24 hours. Of course, we have a book now called Reflections, which is an AA book which is full of philosophy. But as much as I like that book, it isn't quite like the 24 hours. I hate to say that. I wish it weren't true, but it is true. But in somebody's favorite quotations, I don't want to hear that. I want to hear somebody saying, shape up. Oh, yes, I'll do that. And to live with some degree of dignity. I don't know a better way to describe how to tell people. Like, anybody sponsors people, they have deaths in their family, or I'm going through this with a guy now as a movie actor, and his wife has divorced him, and spread all over the scandal. She's just terrible. And all you can tell them, conduct yourself with dignity. You can't always feel well, but by God, you can act well. And you walk through with dignity, and you go back to the funeral, even though you want to weep, you be a source of strength to your family. And they also might say, oh, thank you for telling me that. I was a source of strength, I didn't weep once. We can act our way through with dignity in life's problems. The things that we have some chance to prepare ourselves for are quite simple. The ones that we don't have a chance to prepare ourselves for are the ones that catch us unawares. That's where we have to train ourselves to do that thing and step in. To try to practice self-restraint and to try to evaluate and analyze and admit I'm wrong and forgive if I'm not wrong. So the 11th step is quite simple. To let me bring peace where there's hatred. Where there's hatred, let me bring love. Where there's anger, let me bring joy. Where there's darkness, let me bring light. Because there's a line there, for it is by self-forgetting that one finds. And that sounds so churchy and so abstract. But everything we learn here, it is by self-forgetting, a few brief moments we can take our mind off ourselves. That's when we find the feeling we're looking for, the feeling of humility and being in harmony and at peace with the world around us. And we lose it again and again and again. We talked about joking in the food line today. You know, one of the things we say about the people who feel bad, just hang in there, pal. This too shall pass away. But you remember, good times do the same thing. You're feeling good, are you? This too shall pass away. That's part of the ongoing cycle. So you got to keep doing it, keep tuning, keep working. Hope this won't hit any big ruts now. Oh, God. and live with some degree of dignity, then it's all worthwhile. Thank you.